Thank you. significant performance there of Vaughan Williams' Serenade to Music, performed by the BBC's Federal Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Runicles. Wonderful violin solo by their guest leader, Marcia Crayford. And fabulous performances from the 16 young soloists. The sopranos were Ellen Pritchard, Marie-Claire Breen, Emily Mitchell and Natalie Montefiore. The mezzos, Gemma Brown, Beth Mackay, Rebecca Afonwi-Jones, Linda Jane Workman. The tenors were Stephen Chambers, Warren Gillespie, John Pumphrey and Roland Busfield. And the basses, James Birchall, Owain Brown, Michelle D'Souza and Ross McInroy. An opportunity for all of them to shine in that work. And they're being warmly applauded by Donald Runicles for their proms debut, all 16 of them. And their new chief conductor is bringing the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to their feet again. He spoke so warmly of that piece in his interview earlier and clearly relished every moment of conducting it. And also of conducting those young voices as well. Of course, he's a highly experienced opera conductor, spent 17 years as music director at the San Francisco Opera. But as those young musicians and the BBC Symphony, the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and Donald Runicles, in fact, coming back on stage to bring them back on stage. I was just about to say they were leaving to give us our cue into our interval, but no, he wants them to soak up some more applause, and why not? They were brilliant. More bows and huge smiles. What a fabulous experience that must have been. Well, I think that is now time for the interval, and it's time for us to hop over the road to the Royal College of Music for more of the Proms Literary Festival, where earlier this evening they were discussing the great diarist Samuel Pepys.
Welcome to this latest entry in the hand-tooled volume that is the Proms Literary Festival. We're in front of a lively audience here at the Royal College of Music. My name's Ian McMillan, and here's an extract from my diary. Monday, got up, got dressed, wrote poem, went to bed. Tuesday, got up, got dressed, wrote poem, went to bed. Wednesday, got up, didn't bother getting dressed, wrote poem naked, went to bed. Not that interesting, I think you'll agree. On the other hand, how's this for a diary entry?
November 22nd, 1660. At noon, my wife and I walked to the Old Exchange, and there she bought her a white whisk or neckerchief and put it on, and I a pair of gloves. And so we took coach for Whitehall to Mr. Fox's, where we found Mrs. Fox within, and an alderman of London paying £1,000, or £1,500, in gold upon the table for the king, which was the most gold that ever I saw together in my life. Mr. Fox came in presently and did receive us with a great deal of respect, and then did take my wife and I to the Queen's presence chamber, where he got my wife placed behind the Queen's chair, and I got into the crowd, and by the Queen and the two princesses came to dinner. The Queen, a very little plain old woman, and nothing more in her presence in any respect nor garb than any ordinary woman. The Princess of Orange I had often seen before. The Princess Henrietta is very pretty, but much below my expectation. And her dressing of herself with her hair fried short up to her ears did make her seem so much the less to me. But my wife, standing near her with two or three black patches on and well dressed, did seem to me much handsomer than she.
An extract from one of the greatest diarists of all time, Samuel Pepys, read by Nicholas Rowe. Samuel Pepys was born in 1633, and in a crowded few decades, during which he became a Member of Parliament and Chief Secretary to the Admiralty, lived through turbulent times, the Great Plague, the Fire of London, and the Second Dutch War, all of which he noted down in his diaries, along with his domestic affairs and a tangled and complex private life. The diaries are a remarkable portrait of a man and his enthusiasms, his diversions, and his observations on life. What I love about them is the clarity of the prose and the way the sentences give us insights into Pepys the man as well as the times, his way of thinking, his way of speaking, his way of seeing the world. To celebrate Pepys, 350 years since he began his diaries, I'm joined by the journalist and historian Sir Max Hastings, whose latest book is Did You Really Shoot the Television? A Family Memoir, and the historian Jennet Uglow, whose book about Charles II and his times, A Gambling Man, has been shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize. So, Jennet Uglow, when did you first come across Pepys?
Oh, I've been wondering when I first read Pepys, because once you have read him, he seems to have been with you always, that particular voice. But I think I must have been a student, and it was when the big new edition came out, and that meant that it had all the juicy bits that had been obliterated in previous versions. And I think that we thought, for a long time, just thought Pepys was... Oh, fun, because it was going to be naughty. And also, if you were in the early years of feminism, you know, the Pepys attitude was one that you should jolly well be fighting. And slowly, over the years, I came to see him very differently.
What about you, Max? Was it the juicy
bits?
Well,
me too. I got the naughty bits before Jenny did, because I guess when I was about 13 at school, we were always looking for the unabridged, unexpurgated editions of Pepys. And after that, of course, I think most of us first encountered Pepys when history masters would read aloud the famous passages about the Great Fire of London, about the plague, about the great historical events. But then, when I was in my 30s, I scraped together £150, which was a lot of money in those days, to buy the complete, then new edition. And I read it from cover to cover, and it's been my favourite bedside reading ever since. Because to me, although of course the historical passages, the bits about the great events that he witnessed are important, really it's the human portrait. Mm. It's this fantastically detailed record of a life which... There's probably only half a dozen other examples to match it in the whole of history, aren't there, Jenny, I think?
Yes, I don't think there's anything that matches that particular blend. And I think the extract that we heard is absolutely typical in that not only does he see Stephen Fox, you know, the sort of financial controller of the household with all this gold and go to court, but he remembers exactly that it was a white neckerchief that he bought Elizabeth, you know. And then he's looking at the princesses and he doesn't quite dare let himself think, do I fancy them or not? But he nearly does, you know? So that you're standing with him, and also he puts, it's, I was saying, I think to Max earlier, it's like the theatre. He puts himself almost behind him, so that he's looking across at Elizabeth behind the chair of the Queen, and you're actually physically there.
And one of the strengths, I think, of the diary is his apparent unwillingness to deceive himself. Mm. He's honest. So what kind of man do you think emerges from this account, Max?
Well, silly people laugh at Pepys because he was so frank about his own weaknesses, and God knows there were plenty of them. But there's a very good phrase by one of his contemporaries, Annie Ashley Cooper, said, "There is in everyone two men, the wise and the foolish, and each of them must be allowed his turn." Mm. Well, what's so marvellous about Pepys's diaries is you do get this extraordinary combination of the brilliant observer of great events and also the follies of this man who could be fantastically silly, knew that he was being silly, and yet described it with this lacerating honesty. Mm. And that's what's so irresistible. And I'm always trying to persuade my children, not, I have to say, wholly successfully, to read Pepys, because what I tell them, if ever you're tempted to think that our lives and our century is difficult, look at what Pepys lived through. Is it any wonder that it was a religious age when they all felt a very strong sense, a very real sense of the fear of God. Because in those years covered by the diaries, you saw the fall of Cromwell's government and the Commonwealth, the restoration of Charles II, the real doubts whether the king was going to survive, the Great Fire, the plague, the Dutch sailing up the Medway to bombard Chatham, all this in the space of a few years covered by Pepys. And so much of Pepys is writing about, he's frightened. He's a very frightened man a lot of the time. He's frightened for himself and for his gold and for his family and his future. And he's also frightened for the country. He thinks the whole country may be going to hell in a handcart.
12th of June, 1667. And the truth is, I do fear so much that the whole kingdom is undone, that I do this night resolve to study with my father and wife what to do with the little that I have in money by me. For I give up all the rest that I have in the king's hands for Tangier for lost. So God help us. And God knows what disorders we may fall into, and whether any violence on this office, or perhaps some severity on our persons, as being reckoned by the silly people, or perhaps may, by policy of state, be thought fit to be condemned by the King and Duke of York, and so put to trouble. Though, God knows, I have in my own person done my full duty, I am sure. So, having with much ado finished my business at the office, I home to consider with my father and wife of things, and then to supper and to bed with a heavy heart. The manner of my advising this night with my father was, I took him and my wife up to her chamber and shut the door, and there told them the sad state of the times, how we are like to be all undone, that I do fear some violence will be offered to this office, where all I have in the world is, and resolved upon sending it away, sometimes into the country, sometimes my father to lie in town and have the gold with him at Sarah Giles's. And with that resolution, went to bed, full of fear and fright. Hardly slept all night.
Do you think he's a bit of a social climber, though? Is he somebody who could have liked as a friend, do you think, Jenny?
Oh, you could...
Because he might have written about you that night.
Yeah, he would have written about you. Pepys is a social climber, but that actually puts it in a rather negative way, because one of the things that makes him so honest is this charting of his own conscience, which comes from a particular Puritan style of writing, but also his charting of his own success. And he looks at himself and says, I think I'm doing really well in the office, you know. And then he looks, he says, I've got 40 shillings less this month than last month. So it's... And he wants to get on. I mean, he wants to get on and do well. He wants to be seen. He loves wearing his new velvet coat. He's not a snob.
He was a great enjoyer, I think, wouldn't you, Jenny?
I think that's right. I think he is a great enjoyer. And part of the climbing, it's interesting, is that, and unusual in diaries, is he really loves his work. So when he gets to the office, or he teaches himself maths, or there's a lovely bit where he's measuring a plank in Woolwich Dockyard, and the master carpenter obviously laughs at him, and then Pepys said, because I measured it better than he could. So he enjoys it, and he wants to do well. He's very young. He's in his mid-20s.
We were talking earlier about his marriage, which obviously is a key element in the diaries, that I was trying on Jenny my own view that she wasn't a very happy woman, I don't think, Elizabeth Pepys, was she?
Well, I don't think she was very happy. I think she was a bit dissatisfied. And you put it very well in that Pepys was the great enjoyer. So Elizabeth would be the person that sort of tagged along or is always taken along. And he did, as I said, spend wonderfully on himself and his new velvet cloak and his periwig and his this kind of thing. And he says, and I spent 55 guineas on that, and I gave Elizabeth 13, you know.
But it's one question that intrigues me. Maybe we have so little other detailed contemporary evidence about domestic life of that kind. And I find myself sometimes wondering Was it that the life of women at large was so awful in that period, that they were so restricted and constrained, that maybe the lot of Elizabeth Pepys was no worse than that of many other women? But I've certainly always felt a sense, reading the diaries, that here was Pepys having, although he was very frightened some of the time, although he got terribly despondent, that he was most of the time, he was having a whale of a life. And you never get a sense that his wife shared that whale of a life. I mean, yes, she went out with him, and they went out to dinner in taverns and so on and so forth, and they went occasionally went to theatre together. But one never really feels, he never describes moments of ecstasy with his wife, when he describes plenty of moments of ecstasy with other people.
Yes.
Well, Jenny, isn't that part of the problem?
But I find myself wondering whether it was just a very tough lot to be a wife like Elizabeth Pepys in that era.
And Jenny, isn't that part of the problem, his attitude towards women generally? Perhaps.
Yes, that's part of this great enjoyer self, and also part of the guilt, in that he's not very different from a lot of young men about court, but he is rather different to a sort of decent burger merchant class, perhaps, in the way that he thinks he can pick up a woman, and he eyes them up, and he eyes up their charms, and then he says, I had her in the back of the cab, or in the boat, or up the stairs, or, you know, wherever. And then he'll say, for which I feel very bad. And on Friday it starts again. And Elizabeth has to put up with a lot, and she does at times lose her temper completely and become very desperate. But when Pepys thinks that she is going to have an affair with the person who's come to teach her dancing, he is the double standard incarnate. He is absolutely devastated and awake at night and weeping, and his world has come to an end. So it's complicated, like a lot of relationships are.
Whatever reservations people may have about Pepys the man, Pepys the writer is hard to resist. And Jenny, the example of his writing that you've chosen could hardly be bettered.
September the 2nd, 1666. Some of our maids sitting up late last night to get things ready against our feast today, Jane called up about 3 in the morning to tell us of a great fire they saw in the city. So I rose and slipped on my nightgown and went to her window and thought it to be on the backside of Mark Lane at the farthest. But being unused to such fires as followed, I thought it far enough off, and so went to bed again, and to sleep. By and by, Jane comes and tells me that she hears that above 300 houses have been burned down tonight by the fire we saw, and that it is now burning down all Fish Street by London Bridge. So I made myself ready presently and walked to the Tower, and there got up upon one of the high places, and there I did see the houses at the end of the bridge all on fire, and an infinite great fire on this and the other side of the bridge. So down I went, with my heart full of trouble, to the lieutenant of the Tower, who tells me that it began this morning in the King's Baker's House in Pudding Lane, and that it hath burned St. Magnus's Church and most part of Fish Street already. So I rode down to the waterside, and there saw a lamentable fire, everybody endeavouring to remove their goods and flinging into the river or bringing them into lighters that lay off, poor people staying in their houses as long as till the very fire touched them, and then running into boats or clambering from one pair of stairs by the waterside to another. And among other things, the poor pigeons, I perceive, were loath to leave their houses, but hovered above the windows and balconies till they, some of them, burned their wings and fell down.
Thank you very much to Nicholas Rowe. So, Jenny, you chose that passage. What do you think makes it so special?
I think, as Max has said, it's a very important historical document. And Pepys starts writing his account in very sober tones. He's very much well aware, I think, that in this case he's got to get things right. But it moves almost with the progression of the fire in the distance, the fire coming near, then the fire on the bridge and near the bridge where their friends lived, so it's people they know, and then the sense of the crowds and gathering. The prose gathers pace as the people throw their goods into the boats and so on, and then finally that one haunting detail of the pigeons unable to leave their perches, staying there as long as they could until their feathers burnt and they just dropped down.
One of the things that seems so remarkable is that nobody taught Pepys to write, presumably. I mean, they taught him, obviously, physically to write, but the mastery of detail, that what we know in the 19th and 20th century is that what makes great anecdotage and great historical narrative is a fantastic eye for physical detail. But the frustration of an awful lot of material that one reads from earlier centuries, the raw facts are there about the king went here or there or did this, that or the other, but you don't get these tiny details, and it's the building up of these myriad details that makes Pepys so marvellous, both about his domestic life and about the life of the court and what it was like to serve the king. I mean, obviously, he had the same complaints that civil servants through the ages have about their masters, that modern civil servants may not think much of ministers, but Pepys was a 17th century civil servant, had a pretty thoroughgoing contempt for the monarch he served, and especially the amount of time that he wasted on women, although he's wasted a good deal of time on women himself. But there's nothing quite like Pepys. Wants to say what was life like in that whole century, in that whole period, there is absolutely no other record, I think, to compare with Pepys, is there, Jenny?
Pepys talked to everybody. I mean, he talked to sailors as well as talking to the people in the Navy Board. He talked to actresses.
His curiosity. I suppose that isn't that almost the defining characteristic of the man? This boundless curiosity that he lived in the last century in which an educated, cultured man could know something about everything. After that, in the 18th century, that the whole process of knowledge got out of hand, so that nobody could know about. But Pepys, the curiosity about not only about music, about art, about politics, about science, and it's very infectious that you've only got to read a few pages of Pepys to sense that here is a man who is fascinated by every aspect of what men and women are doing.
Well, let's close the book now on today at the Proms Literary Festival. Goodbye from me, Ian McMillan, and our guests, Jenny Uglow and Max Hastings, and our reader, Nicholas Rowe. And so to bed. Well, after the second half of the prom.
Absolutely. Don't go to bed yet. That was Ian McMillan talking to the journalist and author Max Hastings and the historian Jenny Uglow. The reader was Nicholas Rowe, and the programme was produced by Zahid Worley. And as the promenaders announce that they will be collecting for charity, it is time for me to welcome you back to the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3, where we're enjoying a splendid programme of great English music performed by a great Scottish orchestra, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. Just before the interval, we heard our first piece of Vaughan Williams, his Serenade to Music, wonderful performance, and now we have another of his extremely popular works, his piece for violin, The Lark Ascending. Tonight's soloist is making her debut at the proms, though she's been a popular performer at proms in the park in the past, Nicola Benedetti. She made her name winning BBC Young Musician of the Year 6 years ago, and since then she's been working hard, performing with leading orchestras all over the world, busily recording too. She knows the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra very well indeed, so I'm sure that must help calm her nerves on what must be a big night for her. When she walks onto this stage this evening, she is going to see that we have another packed hall, not a seat spare that I can see. I spoke to her earlier, though, about her feelings performing this particular work, which tries to replicate the very particular flight of the lark, who flies straight upwards, singing all the while, and that makes it a very particular challenge for the soloist.
you rarely get to hear solo violin in the context of playing with a concerto, not playing in the cadenza something flashy and something that's really just showing your stuff, if you know what I mean, showing what you can do. A lot of cadenzas are written that way, but these are very much about the softness and the sort of sensitivity of the violin. And I think that's quite a rare experience for people coming to an orchestral concert.
And rare, I guess, as a performer as well.
It is, yeah, like very that. Much so. And it's kind of very much all eyes on you, but your position is to create something totally different to what cadenzas are usually used for. So it's a very special piece to perform and always leaves you at the end of every performance, actually, with a real specific feeling that's unique, I think.
Now, I know that it's not the first time you've played in the hall. It is your first prom, though.
Yes.
What is it about the Royal Albert Hall that makes you take in a sharp intake of breath?
I think it's quite a frightening place to play. The simplest thing is that it is almost twice as big as most concert halls that you play in. And also, the acoustic is very particular. It's actually quite dry, and it's difficult to believe when you're on stage that what you're doing can really translate to that many people, because there isn't this live echo going around. It's just what you play kind of feels like it's stopping as soon as you finish the note. It just feels like it stops. But in fact, you have to trust that that's not what people feel in the hall, and the sound does carry. So I think it's always a challenge, but the people really make this hall. And I think that's the most special thing about it, that there's something really excited about the feeling of the audience in the Royal Albert Hall. That's been my experience anyway.
They're certainly excited now. That was Nicola Benedetti talking to me just after rehearsal earlier today. Well, Vaughan Williams was of course trying to replicate Lark's song. Let's have a listen to this. That is Lark's song. That was the inspiration for the piece that we're about to hear as we await the arrival on stage of Donald Runnicles, the newly appointed chief conductor of the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. And here he comes now with Nicola Benedetti to perform Vaughan Williams, The Lark Ascending. a very warm reaction to the proms debut of Scottish violinist Nicola Benedetti. The conductor, Donald Runnicles, and all the musicians in the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, giving her a big round of applause. It was an assured and sensitive performance from a young player who I know was nervous. You couldn't guess that, would you? I think there was a large delegation of the Nicola Benedetti fan club here in the hall tonight, and they weren't disappointed. Beautiful piece by Vaughan Williams, the lark ascending. A piece I'm sure not many of you at home I could listen to endlessly. That wonderful folk song theme in the middle, led by the flute there. Written on the eve of the First World War in 1914 by Vaughan Williams. As was, of course, that wonderful piece by his friend Gustav Holst, Mars, the Bringer of War, both of them kind of prescient. But Nicola coming back onto the stage now, huge grin on her face. She has marvellous stage presence and she's obviously thrilled to be here at the Proms. I mentioned before how often she played with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and they really are giving her a great big clap. And she's thanking all of them, pretty much individually. Still clapping, musicians and audience. Will she come back on? Yes, here she comes, with Donald Runnicles as well. He was supporting her very sweetly, I thought, on stage. Clearly very fond of her. He's bringing the woodwind section to their feet. Of course, they played that beautiful theme in the middle, and the horns too. And now, a whole orchestra. Piece of music, isn't it, that has become such a popular feature of the Proms, played by so many great violinists, and always goes down so well. I think for a lot of people, it's a piece of music that just epitomises this glory of natural beauty, but its painful fragility as well. It's terribly sad, very poignant piece, isn't it? Well, it is now time, though, as she leaves the stage, for us to turn our attentions to Elgar's First Symphony, a work which met with immediate acclaim at its premiere. In fact, that's a huge understatement. There were near riots at the first performance. The composer kept on being called back to stage between movements. People were clambering onto their chairs to best show their appreciation. Hans Richter, the great German conductor of the Halle and champion of Teutonic masters like Wagner and Brahms, called it the greatest symphony of modern times. And indeed, many people said it was the first great British symphony to be written. Well, here's what Donald Runnicles said about it when I spoke to him earlier today.
It's a remarkable work, and it's enormously complex. And yes, it begins with this glorious melody, and by the time the melody returns 50, 55 minutes later, you do feel as if you've been through an epic journey, and there's a great deal of autobiographical significance to the work, and once again, glorious to be bringing this piece south of the border to the glorious Royal Albert Hall.
Glorious indeed. Packed tonight as well. It's extraordinary. Every prom that I've been at this season so far has been absolutely straining at the seams. Fantastic to see. Elgar had actually started thinking about the work in 1901, the first symphony that we're going to be hearing soon, but he didn't really crack on with the writing of it until 1907, and then he finished it the following year. All the correspondence at the time between him and his wife and other friends that we can all have access to now refer to how invigorated he was by the process, how wonderful the tunes were that they'd hear him playing on the piano as he composed. Now, there are some indications that the work started as a dedication to the victories of General Gordon, and there are occasional military flashes in the music, particularly in the scherzo. I think it's fair to say Elgar did like a military band. But many now think, though, there is a sense in this work that Elgar knew that his current happiness and the comfort of life in England in the Edwardian age couldn't really go on forever. But it was an absolute triumph when it was first performed and continued to be seen as one of the greats for a long time.
The Daily Mail wrote at the time, there's a wonderful quote, he called it, under the headline, the musical event of the year. So, no hype there. He said, it is quite plain that here we have, perhaps, the finest masterpiece of its type that ever came from the pen of an English composer. Which others have commented at the time. One wonders what Stanford and Parry would have thought of that at the time. But it's fair to say that at that time, at the beginning of the 20th century, there hadn't been something really quite like this before. The Birmingham Daily Post invoked Gerontius, so that this piece was a Gerontius who, instead of dying, has continued to live. And it's all the better for the agony of spirit he has been through. Summing up is a work not merely of English, but of European significance. Well, I referred to the London premiere earlier, but as you can hear, there is movement and activity on the stage. Donald Runicles has reappeared, almost tripping as he stepped over the podium in his enthusiasm to conduct Elgar's First Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
tremendous roar for Donald Runicles and the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra for Elgar's Symphony No. 1. When I spoke to him earlier, Donald Runicles said that he was going to enjoy conducting something that wasn't quite so Teutonic as he had done previously at the Proms. But he clearly enjoyed that. Impassioned, energetic conducting, a man for whom the word gusto was invented, I believe. Returning to the stage now to soak up some more of that applause, bringing the woodwind section to their feet. Now the French horns. Now the rest of the brass section. The two harpists. There was some wonderful playing, wasn't there? A really fabulous performance from the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. And a special kiss on the cheek for their guest leader. Marcia Crayford really has shone, I think, throughout this prom. She's had any number of solos. Wonderful playing. The whole orchestra on their feet now, and the cheers and the claps continue. A symphony, of course, that Elgar himself said, "There is no program beyond a wide experience of human life with a great charity and love and a massive hope in the future." Donald Runicles, the new chief conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, coming back on for his second bow now, receiving a huge round of applause from the orchestra. Very popular figure here in the hall, great fun to watch, bringing his orchestra to their feet now. They'll be back under Donald Runicles tomorrow, playing just one piece, but oh my goodness, what a piece. Mahler's Third Symphony. They'll also be appearing in two more proms later on in the season. 19th and 20th of August, I think I've got that right, under Martin Grabins, a wonderful romantic program of Liszt and Tchaikovsky, and then a late night prom the following night under Ilan Volkov. A mix of English and American experimental traditions, Cage and Cardio and the like. Interesting selection they've got this season. Well, I will be back on BBC Two on Saturday, 7 o'clock, when we'll be broadcasting Mahler 5, the World Orchestra for Peace, under Valery Gergiev. Can't wait for that. That's actually going to be live here on Radio 3 on Thursday. But now it is time for me to say goodbye from the Royal Albert Hall and hand you back to my colleague Jill Anderson at Broadcasting House.
And that was Katie Derham. There's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. And if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then you can by visiting bbc.co.uk/proms and click on Share. If you'd like to hear that prom again at any time you choose, then you can by going to the BBC iPlayer at bbc.co.uk/iPlayer. And each of the proms is there for 7 days after broadcast. Coming up next this evening, Tom Duval visits the Sumela Monastery near Trebizond in the Black Sea region of Turkey, where Pontic Greeks gather every August to celebrate the Feast of the Virgin. That's Songs of Trebizond at 10:15. Till then, I've more music by Vaughan Williams, but this time for one voice and orchestra. The songs of travel have been called the English Winterreise, as they also deal with themes of wandering and remembered love. They were composed in 1904, and Vaughan Williams orchestrated three of them the next year. The remainder were orchestrated by his assistant Roy Douglas. Here to sing the last four songs of travel is Christopher Maltman, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thierry Fisher.
Thank you. Yeah. have trod the upward and the down.